esteemed Datsun truck is a chess fan. One afternoon he gets around to asking Slothrop if he plays. Nope, lying. Not even checkers. Damn, I've hardly had time till now for a good game. I do know a game. Has something of Cantivy been sheltering inside all this time? King game. It's called Prince. Maybe the English even invented it, because you have those princes, right? And we don't. Not that that's wrong, understand, but everybody takes a number, and you start off the Prince of Wales has lost tails, no offense now. The number's going clockwise around the table, and number two has found them, clockwise from that prince, or whatever he wants to call out, actually. He, that's the prince, six or anything, see? You pick a prince first, he starts it, then that number two, or whoever that prince called, says, but first he goes, the prince does, Wales, tails, two, sir, after saying that about how that Prince of Wales has lost his tails, and number two enters, not I, sir. Yes, yes, but, giving Slothrop a most odd look, I mean, I'm not quite sure I really see, you know, the point to it all. How does one win? Ah, how does one win indeed? One doesn't win, easing into it, thinking of Tantivy, one small impromptu counter-conspiracy here. One loses, one by one. Whoever's left is the winner. It sounds rather negative. Garçon? Drinks here are always on the house for Slothrop. They are springing for it, he imagines. Some of that champagne. Want you to just keep it coming, and any time we run out, go get more. Comprende? Any number of slack-jawed subalterns, hearing the magic word, drift over and take seats while Slothrop explains the rules. I'm not sure... Dotson Chuck begins. Baloney, come on, do you good to get out of that chess rut. Right, right, agree the other. Dotson Chuck stays in his seat a bit tense. Bigger glasses, Slothrop hollers at the waiter. How about those beer mugs over there? Yeah, they'd be just fine. The waiter unblasts the Jeroboam of Veuve Clicquot Brut and fills everybody up. Well, the Prince of Wales, Slothrop commences, has lost his tails, and number three has found them. Wales, tails, three, sir. Not I, sir, replies Dotson Truck, kind of defensive about it. Who, sir? Five, sir. Say what? Inquires Five, a Highlander in parade true with a sly look. You fucked up, commands princely Slothrop. So you have to drink up. All the way now. No stopping to breathe or anything. On it goes. Slothrop loses Prince's position to four, and all the numbers change. The Scot is first to drop, making mistakes at first deliberate but soon inevitable. Jeroboams come and go, fat, green, tattered gray foil at the necks giving back the bar's electric radiance. Corks grow straighter, less mushroomy. Dates of dégorgement move further into the war years as the company gets drunker. The Scot has rolled chuckling from his chair, remaining ambulatory for some 10 feet where he goes to sleep against a potted palm. At once another junior officer slides, beaming into his place. The word has osmosed out into the casino, and there is presently a throng of kibitzers gathered around the table waiting for casualties. Ice is being hauled in by a giant block, fern-faulted inside, breathing white off of its faces, to be sledged and chipped into a great wet tub for the procession of bottles being run up from the cellar now in relays. It soon becomes necessary for the harassed waiters to stack empty tankards in pyramids and pour fountain style from the top, the bubble-shot cascades provoking cheers from the crowd. Some joker is sure to reach in and grab one of the mugs on the bottom, sending the whole arrangement swaying, everybody else jumping to salvage what they can before it all comes down, crashing, soaking uniforms and shoes so that it can be set up all over again. The game has switched to rotating prints, where each number called out immediately becomes prints and all the numbers shift accordingly. By this time, it is impossible to tell who's making mistakes and who isn't. Arguments arise. Half the room are singing a vulgar song. Vulgar song. Last night I poked the Queen of Transylvania. Tonight I'll poke the Queen of Burgundy. I'm bordering on the state of schizophrenia, but Queenie is so very nice to me. It's pink champagne and caviar for breakfast, a spot of Chateaubriand with me tea. 10 shilling panatellas now are all that I can smoke. I laugh so much you'd think the world was just a silly joke. But make way for the bloke that's poked the lovely little Queen of Transylvania. Slothrop's head is a balloon, which rises not vertically but horizontally, constantly across the room, whilst staying in one place. Each brain cell has become a bubble. He's been transmuted to black epa grapes, cool shadows, cuvées. He looks across at Sir Stephen Dotson Truck, who is still miraculously upright with a glaze about the eyes. Uh-huh, right, supposed to be counter-conspiring here. Yes, yes, now. He gets involved watching another pyramidal fountain, this time of sweet Tattinger, with no date on the label. Beauty dealers sit like birds along the bar, staring. Noise in the place, incredible. A Welshman with accordion stands on a table playing Lady of Spain in C, just zooming up and down that wheeze box like a maniac. Smoke hangs thick and swirling. Pipes glow in the murk. At least 3 fist fights are in progress. The Prince game is difficult to locate anymore. Girls crowd at the door, giggling and pointing. The light in the room has gone bare brown with swarming uniforms. Slothrop, clutching his tankard, struggles to his feet, spins around once, falls with a crash into a floating crown and anchor game. Grace, he warns himself. Grace. Roisterers pick him up by the armpits and back pockets and fling him in the direction of Sir Stephen Dotson Truck. He makes his way on under a table, a lieutenant or two falling over en route, through the odd pond of spilled bubbly, the odd slew of vomit, till he finds what he imagines to be Dotson Truck's sand-filled cuffs. Hey! Getting himself threaded among the legs of a chair, angling up to locate Dotson Truck's face, haloed by a hanging, fringe-shaded lamp. Can you walk? Carefully swinging his eyes down on Slothrop.
Not sure, actually, that I can stand.
They spend some time at the business of untangling Slothrop from the chair, then standing up, which is not without its complications, locating the door, aiming for it. Staggering, propping each other up, they push through a bottle-wielding, wall-eyed, unbuttoned, roaring, white-faced and stomach-clutching mob, in among the lithe and perfumed audience of girls at the exit, all sweetly high, a decompression lock for the outside. Holy shit! This is the kind of sunset you hardly see anymore, a 19th-century wilderness sunset, a few of which got set down, approximated on canvas. Landscapes of the American West by artists nobody ever heard of, when the land was still free and the eye innocent, and the presence of the Creator much more direct. Here it thunders now over the Mediterranean, high and lonely, this anachronism in primal red, in yellow, purer than can be found anywhere today, a purity begging to be polluted. Of course, empire took its way westward. What other way was there but into those virgin sunsets to penetrate and to foul? End of side 7. To continue, turn the cassette over. Side 8. Gravity's Rainbow by Thomas Pynchon. Continuing on page 250. But out at the horizon, out near the burnished edge of the world, who are these visitors standing, these robed figures, perhaps at this distance hundreds of miles tall, their faces serene, unattached, like the Buddha's, bending over the sea, impassive, indeed as the angel that stood over Lübeck during the Palm Sunday raid, come that day neither to destroy nor to protect, but to bear witness to a game of seduction. It was the next to last London took before her submission, before that liaison that would bring her at length to the eruption and scarring of the wasting pox noted on Roger Mexico's map. Latent in this love she shares with the night-going rake Lord Death, because sending the RAF to make a terror raid against civilian Lübeck was the unmistakable long look that said, "Hurry up and fuck me," that brought the rockets hard and screaming, the A-4s, which were to have been fired anyway, a bit sooner instead. What have the watchmen of World's Edge come tonight to look for? Deepening on now, monumental beings, stoical, on toward slag, toward ash, the color the night will stabilize at. Tonight, what is there grandiose enough to witness? Only Slothrop here, and Sir Stephen, blithering along, crossing shadow after long prison bar shadow cast by the tall trunks of palms lining the esplanade. The spaces between the shadows are washed a very warm sunset red now, across grainy chocolate beach. There seems to be nothing happening of any moment. No traffic whispering in the circular driveways. No milliards of francs being wagered because of a woman or an entente of nations at any of the tables inside. Only the somewhat formal weeping of Sir Stephen, down now on one knee in the sand, still warm from the day, soft and strangled cries of despair held in, so testifying to all the repression he ever underwent that even Slothrop can feel in his own throat sympathetic flashes of pain for the effort it is clearly costing the man.
Oh, yes, yes, you know, I can't. No. I assumed that you knew, but then why should they tell you? They all know I'm an office joke. The people even know. Nora's been the sweetheart of the psychic crowd for years and years. That's always good for some bit of copy in the news of the world.
Oh, yeah, Nora. That's that Dane that was caught that time with the kid who can change his color, right? Wow. Sure, that Nora Dotson truck. I knew your name was familiar. But Sir Stephen has gone on.
Had a son, yes, we came complete with sensitive son, boy about your age, Frank. I think they sent him to Indochina. They're very polite when I ask, very polite, but they won't let me find out where he is. They're good chaps at Fitzmaurice House, Lothrop. They mean well. It's been... most of it's been my fault. I did love Nora, I did, but there were other things, important things. I believed they were, I still do, I must. As she got along, you know, they do get that way. You know how they are, demanding, always trying to drag you into bed. I couldn't, shaking his head, his hair now incandescent orange in this twilight. I couldn't. I'd climbed too far, another branch. Couldn't climb back down to her. She might even have been happy with even a touch now and then. Listen, Slothrop, your girl, your Katya, she's very lovely, you know.
I know.
They think I don't care anymore. You can observe without passion, bastards. No, I didn't mean that, Slothrop. We're all such mechanical men doing our jobs. That's all we are. Listen, how do you think I feel when you're off with her after every lesson? I'm an impotent man. All I have to look forward to is a book, Slothrop, a report to write. Hey, Ace, don't get angry. I'm harmless. Go ahead, hit me. I'll only fall over and bounce right up again. Watch.
He demonstrates.
I care about you, both of you. I do care, believe me, Slothrop.
Okay, tell me what's going on.
I care.
Fine, fine.
My function is to observe you. That's my function. You like my function? You like it? Your function is learn the rocket, inch by inch. I have to send in a daily log of your progress, and that's all I know.
But that's not all. He's holding something back, something deep. And fool, Slothrop is too drunk to get at it with any kind of style. Me and Katya, too? You looking through the keyhole? Sniffling.
What difference does it make? I'm the perfect man for it, perfect. I can't even masturbate half the time. No nasty jism getting all over their reports, you know. Wouldn't want that. Just a neuter, just a recording eye. They're so cruel.
I don't think they even know, really. They aren't even sadists. There's just no passion at all. Slothrop puts a hand on his shoulder. The suit padding shifts and bunches over the warm bone beneath it. He doesn't know what to say, what to do. Himself, he feels empty and wants to sleep. But Sir Stephen is on his knees, just about quaking at the edge of it, to tell Slothrop a terrible secret, a fatal confidence concerning the penis he thought was his own. Lead tenor.
'Twas the penis he thought was his own. Just a big playful boy of a bone, with a stout purple head sticking up from the bed, with a girlies all play telephone, bass, telephone.
Inner voices. But they came through the hole in the night, bass, and they sweet-talked it clear out of sight. Inner voices.
Out of sight.
Tenor.
Now he sighs all alone, with a heartbroken moan, for the penis he thought was his own.
Inner voices.
Was his own.
The figures out to sea have been attending, growing now even more windy and remote as the light goes cold and out. They are so difficult to reach across to, difficult to grasp. Carol Eventier, trying to confirm the Lübeck Angel, learned how difficult. He and his control, Peter Saxa, both floundering in the swamp between the worlds. Later on in London came the visit from that most ubiquitous of double agents, Sammy Hilbert Space, whom everyone had thought in Stockholm, or was at Paraguay. Here, then, the kindly scumbroid face scanning Eventier quick as a fire-controlled dish antenna and even less mercy. I thought I'd... You thought you'd just check in. Telepathic, too. God, he's amazing, ain't he? But the fishy eyes will not let up. It is a rather bare room, the address behind Gallaho Mews ordinarily reserved for cash transactions. They have summoned Evantyr up from the White Visitation. They know in London how to draw pentacles, too, and cry conjurations, how to bring in exactly the ones they want. The tabletop is crowded with glasses, smudged, whitish, emptied, or with residues of deep brown and red drinks, with ashtrays and with debris from artificial flowers, which old Sammy here has been plucking, unpeeling, twisting into mysterious curves and knots. Train smoke blows in a partly opened window. One wall of the room, though blank, has been eroded at over years by shadows of operatives, as certain mirrors in public easing places have been by the images of customers. A surface-gathering character like an old face. But then you don't actually talk to him. Ah, Sammy's so good at this. Softly, softly. I mean, it's none of your telegraphers in the middle of the night having a bit of a chat sort of thing. No, no. Evantyr understanding now that they've been seeing transcripts of everything that comes through from Peter Saxa, that what Evantyr himself gets to read is already censored, and that it may have been this way for a while now. So relax. Grow passive, watch for a shape to develop out of Sammy's talking, a shape that really Evantyr knows already, as we do working out acrostics. He's called up to London, but they aren't asking to be put in touch with anyone, so it's Saxa himself they're interested in. And the purpose of this meeting is not to commission Evantyr, but to warn him. To put a part of his own hidden life under interdiction. Bits, tones of voice, choices of phrasing now come flying together. Must have been quite a shock to find himself over there. Had a Saxa or two of me own to worry about. Keep you out of the street, at least. See how you're holding up, old Saxa, too, of course. Need to filter out personalities, you see, from the data. Easier for us that way. Out of the street. Everyone knows how Saxa died. But no one knows why he was out there that day, what led up to it. And what Sammy is telling Evantyr here is, don't ask. Then will they try to get to Nora, too? If there are analogies here, if Evantyr does somehow map on to Peter Saxa, then does Nora Dotson-Truck become the woman Saxa loved, Lainey Perkler? Will the interdiction extend to Nora's smoky voice and steady hands, and is Evantyr to be kept for the duration, perhaps for his life, under some very sophisticated form of house arrest for crimes that will never be told him? Nora still carries on her adventure, her ideology of the Zero, firm among the stone-swept hair of the last white guardians at the last step off into the black, into the radiant. But where will Lainey be now? Where will she have wandered off to, carrying her child and her dreams that will not grow up? Either we didn't mean to lose her, either it was an ellipsis in our care, in what some of us will even swear is our love, or someone has taken her, deliberately, for reasons being kept secret. And Saxa's death is part of it, too. She has swept with her wings another life, not husband Franz, who dreamed of, prayed for exactly such a taking, but instead is being kept for something quite different. Peter Saxa, who was passive in a different way, is there some mistake? Do they never make mistakes, or why is he here rushing with her toward her own end? As indeed Evantyr has been sucked along in Nora's furious wake, her body blocking from his sight everything that lies ahead. The slender girl, strangely grown oaken, broad, maternal, all he has to go by is the debris of their time sweeping in behind from either side, looping away in long helices into the dusty invisible where a last bit of sunlight lies on the stones of the road. Yes, however ridiculously, he is acting out Franz Perkler's fantasy for him, here crouched on her back, very small, being taken. Taken forward into an ether wind whose smell, no, not that smell, last encountered just before his birth, the void long before he ought to be remembering, which means if it's here again, then they are being pushed backward by a line of police. Peter Saxa is jammed inside it, trying to keep his footing, no escape possible. Lainey's face moving, restless, against the window of the Hamburg Flyer. Concrete roads, pedestals, industrial towers of the Mark flying away at over 100 miles an hour, the perfect background. Brown, blurred, any least mistake in the points in the roadbed at this speed and they're done for. Her skirt is pulled up and back, the bare bottoms of her thighs marked red from the train seat, turned toward him. Yes, in the imminence of disaster, yes, whoever's watching, yes. Lainey, where are you? She was at his elbow not 10 seconds ago. They'd agreed beforehand to try and keep together. but there are two sorts of movement out here. As often as the chance displacements of strangers across a clear skirmish line from the force will bring together people who remain that way for a time in love that can even make the oppression seem a failure, so too love here in the street can be taken centrifugally apart again. Faces seen for the last time here. Words spoken idly over your shoulder, taking for granted she's there, already last words. Will Walter be bringing wine tonight? I forgot to. It's a private joke. His forgetting, going around in some adolescent confusion, hopelessly in love, too, by now, with the little girl. She is his refuge from society, parties, clients. Often she is his sanity. He's taken to sitting for a little while each night beside her bed, late at night, watching her sleep with her bottom up in the air and face in the pillow. The purity, the rightness of it. But her mother, in her own sleep, grinds her teeth often these nights, frowns, talks in a tongue he cannot admit he might some time or place know and speak fluently. Just in this past week, what does he know of politics? But he can see that she has crossed a threshold, found a branching of the time, where he might not be able to follow. You're her mother. What if they arrest you? What happens to her? That's what they... Peter, can't you see they want a great swollen tit with some atrophied excuse for a human bleeding around somewhere in its shadows? How can I be human for her, not her mother? Mother, that's a civil service category. Mothers work for them. They're the policemen of the soul. Her face darkened, judaized by the words she speaks, not because it's out loud, but because she means it, and she's right. Against her faith, Doxa can see the shallows of his own life, the bathtub stagnancy of those soirees where for years not even the faces changed, too many tepid years. But I love you. She brushes hair back from his sweating forehead. They lie beneath a window, through which street and advertising light blow constantly, lapping at their skins, at their roundings and shadows, with spectra colder than those of the astrologer's moon. You don't have to be anything you aren't, Peter. I wouldn't be here if I didn't love who you are. Did she goad him into the street? Was she the death of him? In his view from the other side, no. In love, words can be taken too many ways, that's all. But he does feel he was sent across for some particular reason. And Ilse, vamping him with her dark eyes. She can say his name, but often to flirt with him she won't, or she'll call him Mama. No, no, that's Mama. I'm Peter. Remember Peter? Mama. Lainey only gazes, a smile held between her lips, almost, he must say, smug, allowing the mix-up in names to fall, to set up male reverberations she can't be ignorant of. If she doesn't want him out in the street, why does she only keep her silence at such moments? I was only glad she wasn't calling me Mama, Lainey thought she'd explain, but that's too close to ideology. It's nothing he can be comfortable with yet. He doesn't know how to listen to talk like that as more than slogans strung together. Hasn't learned to hear with a revolutionary heart, won't ever, in fact, be given enough time to gather a revolutionary heart from the bleak, comradely love of the others. No, no time for it now, or for anything but one more breath, the rough breath of a man growing afraid in the street. Not even enough time to lose his fear in the time-honored way, no, because here comes Schutzmann Jöche, truncheon already in backswing, the section of communist head moving into view for him, stupidly, so unaware of him and his power, the Schutzmann's first clear shot all day. Oh, his timing is perfect. He feels it in arm and out the club, no longer flabby at his side, but tensed back now around in a muscular curve at the top of his swing, peak of potential energy, far below that gray vein in the man's temple, frail as parchment, standing out so clear, twitching already with its next-to-last pulse beat, and shit! Oh, how beautiful. During the night, Sir Stephen vanishes from the casino, but not before telling Slothrop that his erections are of high interest to Fitzmaurice House. Then in the morning, Tatcher comes storming in, madder than a wet hen, to tell Slothrop that Sir Stephen's gone. Suddenly everybody is telling Slothrop things, and he's barely awake. Rain rattles at the shutters and windows. Monday mornings, upset stomachs, goodbyes. He blinks out at the misted sea, the horizon mantled in gray, palms gleaming in the rain, heavy and wet and very green. It may be that the champagne is still with him, For 10 extraordinary seconds, there's nothing in his field but simple love for what he's seeing. Then, perversely aware of it, he turns away back into the room. Time to play with Katya now. Her face is as pale as her hair. A rain witch. Her hat brim makes a chic, creamy green halo around her face. Well, he's gone, then. Keenness of this order might work to provoke her. It's too bad. Then again, maybe it's good. Never mind him. How much do you know, Svathrop? What's that mean, never mind him? What do you do, just throw people away? Do you want to find out? He stands twisting his mustache. Tell me about it. You bastard. You've sabotaged the whole thing with your clever little collegiate drinking game. What whole thing, Katya? What did he tell you? She moves a step closer. Svathrop watches her hands, thinking of army judo instructors he's seen. It occurs to him he's naked, and also, seems to be getting a hard-on here. Look out, Svathrop, and nobody here to note it or speculate why. Sure didn't tell me you knew any of that judo. Must have taught you it in that Holland, huh? Sure, little things, singing in descending childish thirds. Give you away, you know. Ah! Exasperated, she rushes in, aims a chop at his head, which he's able to dodge, goes diving in under her arm, lifts her in a fireman's carry, throws her against the bed, and comes after her. She kicks a sharp heel at his cock, which is what she should have done in the first place. Her timing, in fact, is drastically off all through this, else she would likely be handing Slothrop's ass to him. It may be that she wants her foot to miss, only scraping Slothrop along the leg as he swerves now, grabs her by the hair and twists an arm behind her, pushing her face down on the bed. Her skirt is up over her ass, her thighs squirming underneath him, his penis in terrific erection. Listen, cunt, don't make me lose my temper with you. Got no problems at all hitting women. I'm the Cagney of the French Riviera, so look out. I'll kill you. What, and sabotage the whole thing? Katya turns her head and sinks her teeth in his forearm, up near the elbow where the pentothal needles used to go in. Ow, shit! He lets go the arm he's been twisting, pulls down underwear, takes her by one hip and penetrates her from behind, reaching under to pinch nipples, paw at her clitoris, rake his nails along inside her thighs. Mr. Technique here. Not that it matters, they're both ready to come. Katya first, screaming into the pillow, Slothrop a second or two later. He lies on top of her, sweating, taking great breaths, watching her face turned three quarters away, not even a profile, but the terrible face that is no face, gone too abstract, unreachable. The notch of eye socket, but never the label eye. Only the anonymous curve of cheek, convexity of mouth, a noseless mask of the other order of being, of Katya's being, the lifeless non-face that is the only face of hers he really knows or will ever remember. Hey, Katya, is all he says. But here's only her old residual bitterness again. And they are not, after all, to be lovers in parachutes of sunlit voile, lapsing gently, hand in hand, down to anything meadowed or calm. Surprised? She has moved away, releasing his cock into the cold room. What's it like in London, Svathrop, when the rockets come down? What? After fucking, he usually likes to lie around, just smoke a cigarette, think about food. You don't know it's there till it's there. See, till after it's there. If it doesn't hit you, then you're okay till the next one. If you hear the explosion, you know you must be alive. That's how you know you're alive. Right. She sits up, pulling underpants back up and skirt back down, goes to the mirror, starts rearranging her hair. Let's hear the boundary layer temperatures while you're getting dressed. Boundary layer temperature T sub E, what is this? Rises exponentially till Brennschluss, around 70 miles range, eh? And then there's a sharp cusp, 1200 degrees, then it drops a little, minimum of 1050 till you get out of the atmosphere, then there's another cusp at 1080 degrees. Stays pretty steady till re-entry, blah, blah, blah. The bridge music here, bright with xylophones, is based on some old favorite that will comment ironically but gently on what is transpiring. A tune such as school days, or come, Josephine, in my flying machine, or even there'll be a hot time in the old town tonight. Take your pick, slowing and fading to a glassed-in porch downstairs, Slothrop and Katya tete-a-tete, alone except for a number of musicians in the corner groaning and shaking their heads, plotting how to get Cesar Flebotimo to pay them for a change. Bad gig, bad gig. Rain bats against the glass. Lemon and myrtle trees outside shake in the wind. over croissants, strawberry jam, real butter, real coffee. She has him running through the flight profile in terms of wall temperature and Nusselt heart transfer coefficients, computing in his head from Reynolds numbers she flashes him, equations of motion, damping, restoring moments, methods of computing Brenschluss by IG and radio methods, equations, transformations. Now jet expansion angles. I'll give you altitude. You tell me the angle. Katya, why don't you tell me the angle? She was pleased once to think of a peacock courting, fanning his tail. She saw it in the colors that moved in the flame as it rose off the platform, scarlet, orange, iridescent green. There were Germans, even SS troops, who called the rocket Der Pfau, Pfau 2, ascending programmed in a ritual of love. At Brenschluss, it is done. The rocket's purely feminine counterpart, the zero point at the center of its target, has submitted. All the rest will happen according to laws of ballistics. The rocket is helpless in it. Something else has taken over, something beyond what was designed in. Katya has understood the great airless arc as a clear allusion to certain secret lusts that drive the planet and herself and those who use her, over its peak and down, plunging, burning toward a terminal orgasm, which is certainly nothing she can tell Swathrop. They sit listening to gusts of rain that's nearly sleet. Winter gathers, breathes, deepens. A roulette ball goes rattling somewhere back in another room. She's running. Why? Has he come too close again? He tries to remember if she always needed to talk this way, in draw shots, rebounding first before she could touch him. Find time to start asking. He's counter-conspiring in the dark, jimmying doors at random, no telling what'll come out. Dark basalt pushes up out of the sea. A vaporous scrim hangs across the headland and its chateaus, turning it all to a grainy antique postcard. He touches her hand, moves his fingers up her bare arm, reaching. Come on upstairs, says Slothrop. She may have hesitated, but so briefly that he didn't notice. What have we been talking about all this time? The A4 rocket. She looks at him for a long time. At first he thinks she's about to laugh at him, then it looks like she'll cry. He doesn't understand. Oh, Slothrop, no, you don't want me. What they're after, May, but you don't. No more than A4 wants London, but I don't think they know about other selves, yours or the rockets. No, no more than you do. If you can't understand it now, at least remember. That's all I can do for you. They go back up to her room again. Cock, cunt, the Monday rain at the windows. Slothrop spends the rest of the morning and early afternoon studying professors Schiller on regenerative cooling, Wagner on combustion equations, Power and Beck on exhaust gases and burning efficiency, and the pornography of blueprints. At noon, the rain stops. Katya is off on chores of her own. Slothrop passes a few hours downstairs in the bar, waiters who catch his eye smiling, holding up bottles of champagne, wiggling them invitingly. No, merci, no. He's trying to memorize the organization chart at that Peenemünde. As light begins to spill from the overcast sky, he and Katya are out taking a walk, an end-of-the-day stroll along the esplanade. Her hand is gloveless and icy in his, her narrow black coat making her taller, her long silences helping to thin her for him nearly to fog. They stop, lean against a railing, he watching the midwinter sea, she the blind and chilly casino poised behind them. Colorless clouds slide by endlessly in the sky. I was thinking of the time I came in on you, that afternoon. He can't quite bring himself to get specific out loud, but she knows he means the Himmler Spielsaal. She has looked around sharply. So was I. Their breaths are torn into phantoms out to sea. She has her hair combed high today in a pompadour, her fair eyebrows plucked to wings, darkened, eyes rimmed in black, only the outboard few lashes missed and left blonde. Cloud light comes slanting down across her face, taking away color, leaving little more than a formal snapshot, the kind that might appear on a passport. Hey, and you were so far away then, I couldn't reach you. Then, something like pity comes into her face and goes again. But her whisper is lethal and bright as sudden wire. Maybe you'll find out. Maybe in one of their bombed-out cities, beside one of their rivers or forests, even one day in the rain it will come to you. You'll remember the Himmler Spielsaal and the skirt I was wearing. Memory will dance for you, and you can even make it my voice saying what I couldn't say then or now.
Oh, what is it? She smiles here to him only for that second. Already gone. Back to the mask of no luck, no future. Her face is rest state, preferred, easiest. They are standing among black, curly skeletons of iron benches on the empty curve of this esplanade, banked much more steeply than the waking will ever need. Vertiginous, trying to spill them into the sea and be rid of this. The day has grown colder. Neither of them can stay balanced for long. Every few seconds, one or the other must find a new footing. He reaches and turns up the collar of her coat, holds her cheeks then in his palms. Is he trying to bring back the color of flesh? He looks down, trying to see into her eyes, and is puzzled to find tears coming up to fill each one, soaking in among her lashes, mascara bleeding out in fine black swirls, translucent stones trembling in their sockets. Waves crash and drag at the stones of the beach. The harbor has broken out in whitecaps, so brilliant they can't be gathering their light from this drab sky. Here it is again, that identical-looking other world. Is he going to have this to worry about now? What the... Look at these trees, each long frond hanging, stung, dizzying in laborious dry point against the sky, each so perfectly placed. She has moved her thighs and the points of her hips up to touch him through her coat. It might still, after all, be to help bring him back, her breath a white scarf, her tear trails winter-lit ice. She feels warm, but it's not enough. Never was. Nope. He understands, all right. She's been meaning to go for a long time. Braced for the wind the whitecaps imply, or for the tilt of the pavement, they hold each other. He kisses her eyes, feels his cock again begin to swell with a good old, bad old, old anyhow, lust. Out at sea, a single clarinet begins to play, a droll melody joined in on after a few bars by guitars and mandolins. Birds huddle bright-eyed on the beach. Katya's heart lightens a little at the sound. Slothrop doesn't yet have the European reflexes to clarinets. He still thinks of Benny Goodman and not of clowns or circuses. But wait, aren't these kazoos coming? Yeah, a lot of kazoos. A kazoo band. Late that night, back in her room, she wears a red gown of heavy silk. Two tall candles burn an indefinite distance behind her. He feels the change. After making love, she lies propped on an elbow, watching him, breathing deep, dark nipples riding with the swell, as boys ride on the white sea. But a patina has formed on her eyes. He can't even see her accustomed retreat this last time, dimmed, graceful, to the corner of some inner room. Katya. Shh. Breaking dreamy fingernails down the morning over the Côte d'Azur toward Italy. Slothrop wants to sing, decides to, but then can't think of anything that'd work. He reaches an arm without wetting his fingers, snuffs the candles. She kisses the pain. It hurts even more. He falls asleep in her arms. When he wakes, she is gone, completely. Most of her never-worn clothes still in the closet. Blisters and a little wax on his fingers, and one cigarette stubbed out before its time in an exasperated fishhook. She never wasted cigarettes. She must have sat, smoking, watching him while he slept. Until something... He'll never be asking her what triggered her, made it impossible to stay till cigarettes end. He straightens it out, finishes it. No point wasting smokes, is there, with a war on? Ordinarily, in our behavior, we react not singly but complexly to fit the ever-present contents of our environment. In old people, Pavlov was lecturing at the age of 83, that matter is altogether different. Concentrating on one stimulus, we exclude by negative induction other collateral and simultaneous stimuli because they often do not suit the circumstances, are not complementary reactions in the given setting. Thus, Pointsman never shows these excursions of his to anyone. Reaching for some flower on my table, I know the cool mosaic of my room begin its slow inhibitory dissolve around the bloom, the stimulus, the need that brighter burns as brightness quickly sucked from objects all around now concentrates, yet less than blinding, focuses to flame. Whilst there yet, in the room's hypnotic evening, the others lurk.
the books, the instruments, the old man's clothes, an old Gorodsky stick, glazed now but with their presences, their spirits or memories I kept of where they were, are cancelled for this moment by the flame. The reach toward the frail and waiting flower, and so one of them, pen or empty glass, is knocked from where it was, perhaps to roll beyond the blank frontiers of memory. Yet this, be clear, is no senile distraction, but concentrating, such as younger men can easily and laughing dodge, their world presenting too much more than one mean loss. And out here, 83, the cortex slack, excitatory processes eased to cinders by inhibitions tweaking calloused fingers. Each time my room begins its blur, I feel I've looked in on some city's practice blackout, such as must come should Germany keep on that road of madness. Each light winking out, except at last for one bright, stubborn bloom the wardens cannot quench, or not this time. The weekly briefings at the White Visitation are all but abandoned. Hardly anyone sees the old brigadier about these days. There is evidence of a budgetary insecurity begun to filter in among the cherub-crusted halls and nooks of the Pisces facility. "The old man's funking," cries Myron Grunton, none too stable himself these days. The Slothrop group are gathered for their regular meeting in the ARF wing. "He'll shoot down the whole scheme. All it'll take is one bad night." A degree of well-bred panic can be observed among those present. In the background, laboratory assistants move about cleaning up dog shit and calibrating instruments. Rats and mice, white and black, and a few shades of gray run clattering on their wheels in 100 cages. Pointsman is the only one here maintaining his calm. He appears unruffled and strong. His lab coats have even begun lately to take on a Savile Row serenity, suppressed waist, flaring vents, finer material, rather rakishly notched lapels. In this parched and fallow time, he gushes affluence. After the baying has quieted down at last, he speaks, soothing, "There's no danger." "No danger?" screams Aaron Throster, and a lot of them are off again, muttering and growling. "Slothrop's knocked out Dotson truck and the girl in one day. The whole thing is falling apart, pointsman. Since Sir Stephen came back, Fitzmaurice House has dropped out of the scheme, and there's been embarrassing inquiries down from Duncan Sands." "That's the PM's son-in-law, pointsman. Not good, not good. We've already begun to run into a deficit. Funding, if you can keep your head, is available, and will be coming in before long, certainly before we run into any serious trouble. Sir Stephen, far from being knocked out, is quite happily at work in Fitzmaurice House, and is at home there, should any of you wish to confirm. Miss Borgesius is still active on the program, and Mr. Duncan Sands is having all his questions answered. But best of all, we are budgeted well into fiscal 46 before anything like a deficit begins to rear its head." "Your interested parties again?" says Rollo Grost. "I noticed Clive Mossmoon from Imperial Chemicals closeted with you day before yesterday," Edwin Treacle mentions now. "Clive and I took an organic chemistry course or two together back at Manchester. Is ICI one of our sponsors, pointsman?"
"No," smoothly. "Mossmoon actually is working out of Mallet Street these days. I'm afraid we were up to nothing more sinister than a bit of routine coordination over this Schwarz Kommando business."
"The hell you were. I happen to know, Clive, that ICI am managing some sort of polymer research." They stare at each other. One is lying, or bluffing, or both are, or all of the above. But whatever it is, pointsman has a slight advantage. By facing squarely the extinction of his program, he has gained a great bit of wisdom, that if there is a life force operating in nature, still there is nothing so analogous in a bureaucracy, nothing so mystical. It all comes down, as it must, to the desires of individual men. Oh, and women, too, of course, bless their empty little heads. But survival depends on having strong enough desires, on knowing the system better than the other chap, and how to use it. It's work, that's all it is, and there's no room for any extra-human anxieties. They only weaken, effeminize the will. A man either indulges them or fights to win, und so weiter. I do wish ICI would finance part of this, pointsman smiles.
"Lame, lame," mutters the younger Dr. Grost.
"What's it matter?" cries Aaron Throster. "If the old man gets moody at the wrong time, this whole show can prang." "Brigadier Pudding will not go back on any of his commitments," pointsman very steady, calm. "We have made arrangements with him. The details aren't important.
They never are, in these meetings of his. Treacle has been comfortably sidetracked onto the Moss Moon issue. Rollo Grost's carping asides never get as far as serious opposition and are useful in presenting the appearance of open discussion, as are Throster's episodes of hysteria for distracting the others. So the gathering breaks up. The conspirators head off for coffee, wives, whiskey, sleep, indifference. Webley Silvernail stays behind to secure his audiovisual gear and loot the ashtrays. Dog Vanya, back for the moment in an ordinary state of mind, if not of kidneys, which are vulnerable after a while to bromide therapy, has been allowed a short break from the test stand, and he goes sniffing now over to the cage of rat Ilya. Ilya puts his muzzle against the galvanized wire, and the two paws this way, nose to nose, life and life. Silvernail, puffing on a hook-shaped stub, lugging a 16mm projector, leaves Arf by way of a long row of cages, exercise wheels strobing under the fluorescent lights. Careful use, guys. Here comes the screw. Oh, he's okay, Louis. He's a regular guy. The others laugh. Then what's he doing in here, huh? The long white lights buzz overhead. Gray-smocked assistants chat, smoke, linger at various routines. Look out, Lefty. They're coming for you this time. Watch this, chuckles Mouse Alexei. When he picks me up, I'm gonna shit right in his hand. Better not. Hey, you know what happened to Slug, don't you? They fried him when he did that, man. The first time he fucked up running that maze. 100 volts. They said it was a accident. Yeah, sure it was. From overhead, from a German camera angle, it occurs to Webley Silvernail this lab here is also a maze. Isn't it now? Behaviorists run these aisles of tables and consoles just like rats and mice. Reinforcement for them is not a pellet of food, but a successful experiment. But who watches from above? Who notes their responses? Who hears the small animals in the cages as they mate or nurse or communicate through the gray quadrilles or, as now, begin to sing, come out of their enclosures, in fact grown to Webley Silvernail size, though none of the lab people seem to be noticing, to dance him down the long aisles and metal apparatus with conga drums and a peppy tropical orchestra taking up the very popular beat and melody of Pavlovia, Begin. It was spring in Pavlovia, I was lost in a maze. Lysol breezes perfumed the air, I'd been searching for days. I found you in a cul-de-sac, as bewildered as I. We touched noses, and suddenly my heart learned how to fly. So together we found our way, shared a pellet or two, like an evening in some cafe, wanting nothing but you. Autumn's come to Pavlovia, once again I'm alone, finding sorrow by millivolts back to neurons and bone. And I think of our moments then, never knowing your name. Nothing's left in Pavlovia but the maze and the game. They dance in flowing skeins. The rats and mice form circles, curl their tails in and out to make chrysanthemum and sunburst patterns, eventually all form into the shape of a single giant mouse, at whose eye Silvernail poses with a smile, arms up in a V, sustaining the last note of the song along with the giant rodent chorus and orchestra. One of PWD's classic propaganda leaflets these days urges the Volksgrenadier Setzt V2 ein, with a footnote explaining that V2 means to raise both arms in honorable surrender. More gallows humor, and telling how to say phonetically, I surrender. Is Webley's V here for victory or surrender? They have had their moment of freedom. Webley has only been a guest star. Now it's back to the cages and the rationalized forms of death, death in the service of the one species cursed with the knowledge that it will die. I would set you free if I knew how, but it isn't free out here. All the animals, the plants, the minerals, even other kinds of men are being broken and reassembled every day to preserve an elite few who are the loudest to theorize on freedom, but the least free of all. I can't even give you hope that it will be different someday, that they'll come out and forget death and lose their technology's elaborate terror and stop using every other form of life without mercy to keep what haunts men down to a tolerable level and be like you instead, simply here, simply alive. The guest star retires down the corridors. Lights, all but a sprinkling, are out at the White Visitation. The sky tonight is deep blue, blue as a navy greatcoat, and the clouds in it are amazingly white. The wind is keen and cold. Old Brigadier Pudding, trembling, slips from his quarters down the back stairs by a route only he knows, through the vacant orangery in the starlight, along a gallery hung to lace dandies, horses, ladies with hard-boiled eggs for eyes, out a small entresol, point of maximum danger, and into a lumber room whose stacks of junk and random blacknesses, even this far from his childhood, are good for a chill, out again and down a set of metal steps, singing, he hopes quietly, for courage. Wash me in the water that you wash your dirty daughter, and I shall be whiter than the whitewash on the wall. At last to D-Wing, where the madmen of the 30s persist. The night attendant is asleep under the Daily Herald. He is a coarse-looking fellow and has been reading the leader. It is an indication of things to come. Next election? Oh, dear. But orders are to let the brigadier pass. The old man tiptoes by, breathing fast. Mucus rattles back in his throat. He's at the age where mucus is a daily companion, a culture of mucus among the old, mucus in a thousand manifestations appearing in clots by total surprise on a friend's tablecloth, rimming his breath passages at night in hard venturi, enough to darken the outlines of dreams and send him awake, pleading. A voice from some cell too distant for us to locate intones, I am blessed Metatron. I am keeper of the secret. I am guardian of the throne. And here the more disturbing wig excesses have been chiseled away or painted over, no point disturbing the inmates. All is neutral tones, soft draperies, impressionist prints on the walls. Only the marble floor has been left, and under the bulbs it gleams like water. Old Pudding must negotiate half a dozen offices or anterooms before reaching his destination. It hasn't yet been a fortnight, but there is already something of ritual to this, of iteration. Each room will hold a single unpleasantness for him, a test he must pass. He wonders if Pointsman hasn't set these up, too. Of course he must. How did the young bastard ever find out? Have I been talking him asleep? Have they been slipping in at night with their truth serums to... And just at the clear emergence of the thought, here is his first test tonight. In the first room, a hypodermic outfit has been left lying on a table, very clear and shining, with the rest of the room slightly out of focus. Yes, mornings I felt terribly groggy, couldn't wake after dreaming. Were they dreams? I was talking, but it's all he remembers, talking while someone else was there listening. He is shivering with fear, and his face is whiter than whitewash. In the second antechamber is an empty red tin that held coffee. The brand name is Savarin. He understands that it means to say Severin. Oh, the filthy, the mocking scoundrel. But these are not malignant puns against an intended sufferer so much as a sympathetic magic, a repetition high and low of some prevailing form, as, for instance, no sane demolition man at his evening dishwater will wash a spoon between two cups or even between a glass and a plate for fear of the trembler it implies. Because it's a trembler tongue he really holds, poised between its two fatal contacts, in fingers aching with having been so suddenly reminded. In the third, a file drawer is left ajar, a stack of case histories partly visible, and an open copy of Kraft Ebbing. In the fourth, a human skull. His excitement grows. In the fifth, a Malacca cane. I've been in more wars for England than I can remember. Haven't I paid enough? Risked it all for them time after time? Why must they torment an old man? In the sixth chamber, hanging from the overhead, is a tattered Tommy up on White Sheet Ridge. Field uniform burned in Maxim holes, black-rimmed as the eyes of Cléo de Mérode. His own left eye shot away. The corpse beginning to stink. No, no, an overcoat, someone's old coat, that's all left on a hook in the wall. But couldn't he smell it? Now mustard gas comes washing in, into his brain with a fatal buzz as dreams will when we don't want them, or when we are suffocating. A machine gun on the German side sings dum-di-di-da-da, an English weapon answers dum-dum, and the night tightens coiling round his body just before H hour. At the seventh cell, his knuckles feeble against the dark oak, he knocks. The lock, remotely, electrically commanded, slams open with an edge of echo trailing. He enters and closes the door behind him. The cell is in semi-darkness, with only a scented candle burning back in a corner that seems miles away. She waits for him, in a tall Adam chair, white body and black uniform of the night, he drops to his knees. Domina Nocturna, shining mother and last love, your servant Ernest Pudding reporting as ordered. In these war years, the focus of a woman's face is her mouth. Lipstick among these tough and too often shallow girls prevails like blood. Eyes have been left to weather and to tears. These days, with so much death hidden in the sky, out under the sea, among the blobs and smears of retro photographs, most women's eyes are only functional. But Pudding comes out of a different time, and Pointsman has considered this detail, too. The brigadier's lady has spent an hour at her vanity mirror with mascara, liner, shadow, and pencil, lotions and rouges, brushes and tweezers, consulting from time to time a loose-leaf album filled with photographs of the reigning beauties of 30 and 40 years ago, so that her reign these nights may be authentic. If not, it is for her state of mind as well as his, legitimate. Her blonde hair is tucked and pinned beneath a thick wig. When she sits with her head down, forgetting the regal posture, the hair comes forward over her shoulders below her breasts. She is naked now, except for a long sable cape and black boots with court heels. Her only jewelry is a silver ring with an artificial ruby not cut to facets but still in the original boule, an arrogant gout of blood extended now, waiting his kiss. His clipped mustache bristles, trembling across her fingers. She has filed her nails to long points and polished them the same red as her ruby. Their ruby. In this light, the nails are almost black. That's enough. Get ready. She watches him undress, medals faintly jingling, starch shirt rattling. She wants a cigarette desperately, but her instructions are not to smoke. He tries to keep her hand still. What are you thinking, Pudding? Of the night we first met. The mud stank. The Archies were chugging in the darkness. His men, his poor sheep, had taken gas that morning. He was alone. Through the periscope, underneath a star shell that hung in the sky, he saw her, and though he was hidden, she saw Pudding. Her face was pale. She was dressed all in black. She stood in no man's land. The machine guns raked their patterns all around her, but she needed no protection. They knew you, mistress. They were your own. And so were you. You called to me. You said, I shall never leave you. You belong to me. We shall be together again and again, though it may be years between, and you will always be at my service. He is on his knees again, bare as a baby. His old man's flesh creeps, coarse-grained in the light from the candle. Old scars and new welts group here and there over his skin. His penis stands at present arms. He smiles. At her command, he crawls forward to kiss her boots. He smells wax and leather and can feel her toes flexing beneath his tongue through the black skin. From the corner of his eye on a little table, he can see the remains of her early evening meal, the edge of a plate, the tops of two bottles, mineral water, French wine. Time for pay now, Brigadier. You shall have 12 of the best, if your offering tonight pleases me. Here is his worst moment. She has refused him before. His memories of the salient do not interest her. She doesn't seem to care for mass slaughter as much as for myth and personal terror, but please, please let her accept. Et Badajoz, whispering humbly, during the war in Spain, the bandera of Franco's legion advanced on the city singing their regimental hymn. They sang of the bride they had taken. It was you, mistress. They were proclaiming you as their bride. She's silent for a bit, making him wait. At last, eyes holding his, she smiles, the component of evil in it she has found he needs taking care of itself as usual. Yes, many of them did become my bridegrooms that day, she whispers, flexing the bright cane. There seems to be a winter wind in the room. Her image threatens to shake apart into separate flakes of snow. He loves to listen to her speak. Hers is the voice that found him from the broken rooms of the Flemish villages he knows. He can tell from the accent the girls who grew old in the Low Countries, whose voices went corrupted from young to old, gay to indifferent, as that war drew out, season into ever more bitter season. I took their brown Spanish bodies to mine. They were the color of the dust and the twilight and of meats roasted to a perfect texture. Most of them were so very young. A summer day, a day of love, one of the most poignant I ever knew. Thank you. you shall have your pain tonight. It's a part of her routine she can enjoy, at least. Though she has never read any classic British pornography, she does feel herself, sure as a fish, well in the local mainstream. Six on the buttocks, six more across the nipples. Whack! Where's that gourd surprise now, eh? She likes the way the blood leaps to cross last night's welts.